It was not until several days later, when Giannini called to remind her about the estate inventory, that Salander took out the crumpled papers. She sat at the kitchen table, smoothed out the documents, and read through them. The inventory covered several pages. There was a detailed list of all kinds of junk. The china in the kitchen cupboards in Gossenberger. Clothing, cameras, and other personal effects. Zaluchenko had not left behind much of real value, and none of the objects had the slightest sentimental value for Salander. She decided that her attitude had not changed since she met with Giannini at the theatre bar. Sell the crap and give the money away. Or something. She was positive that she did not want a single aura of her father's wealth. But she also was pretty sure that Zaluchenko's real assets were hidden where no tax inspector would look for them. Then she opened the title deeds for the property in Nortelje. It was an industrial site of three buildings totaling 215,000 square feet in the vicinity of Skerrid, between Nortelje and Rimbo. The estate appraiser had apparently paid a cursory visit and noted that it was an old brickworks that had been more or less empty and abandoned since it was shut down in the 60s, apart from a period in the 70s when it had been used to store lumber. He noted that the buildings were in extremely poor condition and could not in all likelihood be renovated for any other activity. The term poor condition was also used to describe the north building, which had in fact been destroyed by fire and collapsed. Some repairs, he wrote, had been made to the main building. What gave Salander a jolt was the site's history. Zaluchenko had acquired the property for a song on March 12, 1984, but the signatory on the purchase documents was Agneta Sophia Salander. So Salander's mother had in fact been the owner of the property. Yet in 1987 her ownership had ceased. Zaluchenko had bought her out for 2,000 kroner. After that, the property had stood unused for 15 years. The inventory showed that on September 17, 2003, KAB Import AB had hired the builders Norbig Inc. to do renovations which included repairs to the floor and wall, as well as improvements to the water and electrical systems. Repair work had gone on for 2 months until the end of November, when it was discontinued. Norbig had sent an invoice which had been paid. Of all the assets in her father's estate, this was the only surprising entry. Salander was puzzled. Ownership of the industrial site made sense if her father had wanted to give the impression that KAB Import was carrying on legitimate activities or owned certain assets. It also made sense that he had used her mother as a front in the purchase and had then, for a pittance, bought back the property. But why in heaven's name would he spend almost 440,000 kroner to renovate a ramshackle building, which according to the appraiser was still not being used for anything in 2005? She could not understand it. But she was not going to waste time wondering. She closed the folder and called Giannini.
I've read the inventory. What I said still holds. Sell the shit and do whatever you like with the money. I want nothing from him. Very well. I'll see to it that half the revenue is deposited in an account for your sister, and I'll suggest some suitable recipients for the rest.
Right,
Salander said, and hung up without further discussion. She sat in her window seat, lit a cigarette, and looked out towards Saltschun. Salander spent the next week helping Armansky with an urgent matter. She had to help track down and identify a person suspected of being hired to kidnap a child in a custody battle resulting from a Swedish woman divorcing her Lebanese husband. Salander's job amounted to checking the email of the person who was presumed to have hired the kidnapper. Milton Security's role was discontinued when the parties reached a legal solution. On December 18th, the Sunday before Christmas, Salander woke at 6 and remembered that she had to buy a Christmas present for Palmgren. For a moment she wondered whether there was anyone else she should buy presents for. Giannini, perhaps. She got up and took a shower in no particular hurry, and ate a breakfast of toast with cheese and marmalade, and a coffee. She had nothing special planned for the day, and spent a while clearing papers and magazines from her desk. Then her gaze fell on the folder with the estate inventory. She opened it and reread the page about the title registration for the site in Nortelje. She sighed.
Okay. I have to find out what the hell he had going on there.
She put on warm clothes and boots. It was 8:30 when she drove her burgundy Honda out of the garage beneath Fiskargaten 9. It was icy cold but beautiful, sunshine and a pastel blue sky. She took the road via Slusen and Klarabergsleden and wound her way onto the E18 going north, heading for Norrtälje. She was in no hurry. At 10 she turned into a gas station a few miles outside Skiderit to ask the way to the old brickworks. No sooner had she parked than she realized that she did not even need to ask. She was on a hillside with a good view across the valley on the other side of the road. To the left, towards Norrtälje, she could see a warehouse, some sort of builder's yard, and another yard with bulldozers. To the right, at the edge of the industrial area, about 400 yards from the road, was a dismal brick building with a crumbling chimney stack. The factory stood like a last outpost of the industrial area, somewhat isolated beyond a road and narrow stream. She surveyed the building thoughtfully and asked herself what on earth had possessed her to drive all the way up to Norrtälje. She turned and glanced at the gas station, where a long-distance truck and trailer with the emblem of the International Road Transport Union had just pulled in. She remembered that she was on the main road from the ferry terminal at Kapellskär, through which a good deal of the freight traffic between Sweden and the Baltic countries passed. She started the car and drove out onto the road towards the old brickworks. She parked in the middle of the yard and got out. It was below freezing outside, and she put on a black knitted cap and leather gloves. The main building was on 2 floors. On the ground floor, all the windows had been boarded up with plywood, and she could see that on the floor above many of them had been broken. The factory was a much bigger building than she had imagined, and it was incredibly dilapidated. She could see no evidence of repairs. There was no trace of a living soul, but she saw that someone had discarded a used condom in the yard, and that graffiti artists had attacked part of the façade. Why had Salichenko owned this building? She walked around the factory and found the ramshackle north building to the rear. She saw that the doors to the main building were locked. In frustration, she studied a door at one end of the building. All the other doors had padlocks attached with iron bolts and galvanized security strips, but the lock on the gable end seemed weaker and was in fact attached only with rough spikes. Damn it! It's my building! She looked around and found a narrow iron pipe in a pile of rubbish. She used it to lever open the fastening of the padlock. She entered a stairwell with a doorway to the ground floor area. The boarded-up windows meant that it was pitch black inside, except for a few shafts of light seeping in at the edges of the boards. She stood still for several minutes, until her eyes adjusted to the darkness. She saw a sea of junk, wooden pallets, old machine parts, and lumber, in a workshop that was 150 feet long and about 65 feet wide, supported by massive pillars. The old brick ovens seemed to have been disassembled, and in their place were big pools of water and patches of mould on the floor. There was a stale, foul smell from all the debris. She wrinkled her nose in disgust.